find the answers to questions you may or may not have asked yourself here at Kaleidoscience, Conversations on Cognitive Science. This episode is hosted by Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne.
I think many of us know that when we are in a bad mood that we like to play our favorite songs or listen to a certain playlist. And I think like people who make music themselves, I'm not one of those people, but some people do, also like to play like certain songs. And in our new blog on the topic music and cognition, we want to shed a light on what really happens. And for today, we have invited one guest, and we are very happy that he could join us. So we'd like to welcome Jesper Hohagen.
Hi.
We will start with a little introduction game. I will give you the beginning of sentences, and I would like you to ask you to just finish the sentences, just briefly, don't overthink it. As a kid, I always wanted to be.
I would say a football player, maybe a professional football player or a rock star.
Sure. If I was an emoji, I would be.
Yes, as I told you, I'm not so much into social media, but I would say I would choose the usual smiley one, like just the nice smile emoji.
Like the small smile or the big smile?
The big smile, for sure.
Okay. My favorite thing to do on a day off is?
At the moment, maybe going out with friends or doing a trip with friends and my wife, something like that.
Nice. Right now, I'm most fascinated by?
At the moment, I'm really fascinated by politics, I would say. This is something at the moment I'm really interested in.
Just a quick hint. I don't know when this episode will be released, but we are recording this on the 5th of February, so the Bundestag elections are not too far away, so this is a really hot topic right now. We will see when this airs.
Yes, but yeah, if like fascinating is now like just meant that it's something positive, maybe then we should talk about it, but just like neutral fascinating, yes.
Yeah, this has also come up in another episode we've recorded recently. I feel like
okay.
Politics are a big topic also for other countries right now. So
yes.
Okay, I know it's time to call it a day when.
I would say it depends if I have a certain deadline in work. I would say then I call it a day when I'm ready. Or I think what I've done is good enough. And if not, maybe I try to do something like a 9-to-5 thing and work on my work-life balance and trying to getting better and better with it. Yes.
Nice. So you said when you were younger, you wanted to become a football player. You're definitely not a football player, at least not that I know of. And you're also not a rock star, but you still work with music. Could you explain what you do and how you got there?
I would say sports and music is very important in my life, and it was important when I was a kid, like I said, and it is still very important in my life. And after high school, I actually didn't know if I wanted to become or do something like study sport or study music, or and actually then I discovered some kind of a short text of a flyer about a study program. And then I thought maybe this is a good thing. It was about musicology and how we perceive music and what happens in our body and in our brain when we listen to music and so on. And then I started to study musicology in Bremen. And during the bachelor's, my bachelor's, I got the offer to get a position as a student assistant. And actually, this was the point where I got to know really like music psychological research. So I worked within this within a big research project that actually investigated how regularly music lessons in primary school affects like different areas of like the development of children, emotional wise, social wise, and so on. And so I liked it, and because that I like studied musicology during my master's as well in Cologne, and did also a research internship abroad in Australia at Monash University in Melbourne, where I could join the music psychological research project as well. And after my master's, I pretty much directly started to doing my PhD and being a research assistant at the University of Hamburg at the Institute of for Systematic Musicology. And during my PhD, I investigated the perception, multimodal perception of musical gestures or musical movements in a broad sense. So that was a good connection, good link, because as I said, I was still very interested in sports. And so this music and movement connection and this research field suited very good for my interest. And then I needed somehow a break through my during my PhD, and I did traveling a lot. And then when I came back, I finished my PhD I worked then in a totally different field for 3 years after my PhD in the early education research. And since 2022, at the end of 22, I started my actual position, my postdoc position at the Freiburg Institute of Musicians Medicine in Freiburg. Yeah, this is a institution, and maybe I can add this, that is located at the University of Music in Freiburg and at the medical center of the University of Freiburg. So it's like in between these two universities. And within my actual position, I now started to focus on the research on attentional focus in music. That's a topic that I discovered through like during my PhD work as well. And I was very fascinated about it because actually it came from the sports science field, and now it's like the models and the concepts were transferred more and more into this music performance field. And I started working on that, and now I'm the principal investigator of a bigger project about focus of attention in music. That's what I'm doing right now.
Nice. And then let's maybe directly dive into what you're doing right now, because I think for some research areas, I have like a very clear intuition of what are the things that you measure, because like most science relies on data somehow. And I'm not sure really what the measurements in your case are. Are you maybe just having like questionnaires? Are you doing like measurements with EEG caps. So can you like maybe briefly tell us what like the usual measurements are, or if there's like a mixture and you just need everything and it just depends like on the very specifics of each experiment?
So I would say the last sentence you said is that's totally correct. So actually the methods we are used, like on the one side, the data acquisition and the data analysis is pretty much you can compare it with experimental psychological research on the one hand, and on the other hand, maybe it's like empirical social science work. So we have questionnaires, we're doing qualitative research and interviews, and we use movement analysis tools. So I worked a lot with motion capture systems. We have physiological measures as well. So doing research with EMG sensors or things like this. So I would say it depends on the actually research question and the objective of the current studies. Yes, I would say it's a mixture of different methods, and it's always important to choose maybe the kind of data acquisition methods and data analysis method that suits to the research question and the goal of the study.
Could you briefly explain for the listeners what physiological measures are and what EMG is?
Ah, okay. It's like electromyography. It's like a tool to measure the muscle activity. And one step like further with this information or this measurements, you could maybe like build some biomechanical models. So if you want to ask how maybe you should move in a certain way to perform music on your specific instrument better. Actually, this kind of message comes from the sports science as well. And they are doing it for a long time. And now it's getting more and more coming into this music performance research and this physiological research as well, because lots of studies in the last 20 years have shown that it's highly important how musicians move and what kind of effects that have on the actual musical performance, as well on the on the performance as well, but also on health issues and certain topics in that areas as well. Yes,
I'm just now realizing that our welcome game was like unsuited to ask you, because now I'm interested, and I'm sorry to interrupt maybe the flow of the interview, but what instrument are you playing yourself?
Like I used to play piano regularly, I would say from my age of 6 till I was 18, 19 regularly, but on an amateur level. I did not really deliberate practice to become a professional musician. And I would say since I started to study musicology, I was doing like more sports than actually playing the piano. So maybe, I don't know what is in English, if there's a saying like this, when you doing like when your leisure activity becomes to your profession, then maybe you lost something of your leisure activities. Yes, it's always hard to translate German sayings in English.
And now back to the scientific investigation of this music. I have asked you to describe like the measurements of that apply to the participant, and you said like they are performing music, and then on the other side, because you had like the example of doing sports, and if you like measure the muscle activity And you can also, like, maybe if someone is kicking a ball, then you can, like, measure how far, how fast did the ball go, all these kind of stuff. But when we're talking about music, what are we measuring in music? So, like, maybe, like, the posture affects how you play, but then how do you quantify the difference? And if there is there, like, a quality measure that you can apply, and how objective would that be?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. And actually, this is a very, very big discussion and a big challenge in music performance research, I would say, since 20 or 30 years. Actually, the most studies in the music performance field, and actually in the musical practice as well, like in rehearsals or exams or something like this, the most used measurement is subjective expert ratings. And this, this is, I would say, like the most used outcome measures in music performance, if you really want to measure music performance. But actually, as you say, it's a subjective measure, right? So it's not an objective measure that you can say, but it's hard to measure musical performance in that way. There are like different options. As I said, you can use movement data or physiological data, or you can use acoustical measures like, I don't know, tempo or dynamics or timbre, something like this. But all of this, and you would, I think, you'd say it the same way. It's just a part of a musical performance, right? So actually, yeah. Also, you have not just the expert rating, so maybe like ratings from the audience. It's all also a big part of music performance. So I would say you have to have like really certain specific hypothesis when you start an experiment, like that you, how do you say, that you think that maybe the actually experimental manipulation or the variation affects like this certain kind of outcome measures. And then you can say, okay, it affects this part of musical performance. But I would say it's always hard to say we have just one kind of measurement. And then you would say, okay, and now we know that makes the performance better. So yeah, you're totally right. That's a big challenge in music performance research to find the right outcome measurement.
So basically you measure musical performance using a mix of objective and subjective measures.
Yeah, like in my recent project, the Focus of Attention in Music project, there are different stages, or project phases, you can say. And in the first phase, it's more like explorative and qualitative design we use, because actually we do not know so much about how really people and musicians on different levels, amateurs and experts and professionals, actually what they focus on and in which directions they put their focus. So actually in this first phase, we exploratively try to find out what they actually do, why they're doing music. So this is the first part, and then maybe we can do something like build a preliminary model of focus of attention based on this data we have, on the qualitative data. And then in the next phase, we can try to design like really controlled experiments and give controlled instructions to the participants, to the musicians, and then I have to think about it, what kind of measure we use. I would say I would say there will be maybe three or four consecutive studies. And I, in each study, the focus is maybe on one different kind of measurement. So in the first study, maybe we think to measure movement data and look if a certain focus instruction has an impact on like the movement velocity or the acceleration or the fluency of the movement. And then in the next experiment, maybe we think about measure effects on the visual focus. And then we use like eye tracking glasses to measure where actually the participants visually focus on while they're doing music. And maybe in the third experiment, then we use expert ratings. And ask expert ratings or maybe peer ratings or audience ratings to figure out what their aesthetic judgment is of the performance. So I would say it's important to have what I said, like clear hypotheses for each of the experiment, that you have like a good precise argumentation that you really can explain your results based on a theory or a model. And I would say this is an important thing. And it could be that we use different measurement methods, but we go from study to study.
You have just laid out a multiple phase plan, and I'm assuming you're still in phase one of figuring out the basics, but do you already have like first results that you can tell us, like what are the different things that the musicians focus on during their performances?
Yes, I would say this is the this was actually the goal of this first phase, to try to figure out where actually, what do they do when they're playing music. I would say I'm really like now at the moment I'm analyzing my the interviews, so this is really preliminary. But actually I would say there are different like focus directions, I would say, which occur like not just where there are some clusters or some structures you can say, and this is something like technique, focus on the sound, like focus on the expression, focus on joy, actually, like, or some kind of humor or having fun while playing. And then there are some more, I would say, mental parts. So some people said that maybe they have some visual images while they are playing music, so that they actually think about something that is quite visual. Others maybe have more auditive images, like they think about how actually the sound should be. So these are different dimensions and different directions. And yes, the goal is now to get some structure in all this kind of different answers from the participants. But maybe this is like a few examples of the actually directions, but how you like you can imagine that maybe this can change like from second to second. So this is one of the another big challenge, that it's really hard to measure and actually like real-time focus, because there's a big difference between all the measurements in sports, right? Because there you can have movement tasks in sports science experiments, And imagine you were throwing a dart on a dartboard. It's actually just one movement, and you really can have one focus to doing it, like either maybe focus visually, focus the board, or you focus your arm movement. And but yeah, in music, like through the time, when the time is going on, it can change from note to note, or from motif to motif, or from phrase to phrase. So this would be a challenge as well, to find the right experimental design in the experiments that could address this challenge. Yes.
Do you do studies on people who play a certain instrument? Because I'm thinking, like, if you play saxophone, you maybe are focusing on your breathing, where you are playing the violin. There's also breathing is probably important, but it's maybe not as important as playing like another instrument. Is there like a certain group of people that you are focusing on, or are you investigating across the board?
In this first phase of the project, we were thinking about it in our colloquia and all this stuff, and did a lot of pretests for figure out if we should like do constrain it and say, okay, we just take this group of instruments or another group, or what we're doing with singers, because actually this is something totally different as well, because they have their instrument in their body. So and then for the first phase, we figured out, and we decided to do like two different studies, one with singers and one with instrumental players, because I didn't want to have this this constraint on certain instruments, because I thought in this first phase it's important to like gather every data we can get, like as much data. And there are some similarities between a hornet player and a guitarist, and there are some like instrumental specific differences for sure. And during the analysis, we have to have a focus on that to make like then comparisons or distinguish these parts at the end. So yeah, you're right. There are like in different like sports movements, there are like different tasks and challenges as well.
So earlier you mentioned music gestures. Could you maybe elaborate a bit more what it is and how it works and what you're interested in about musical gestures?
Yes. The first thing I would say is, like, you can say musical gestures is another word for musical movements or movements in music, but actually in different studies and different colleagues and authors in the last 30 years of research have different definitions of what is a musical gesture. You can imagine that. So but there's one, I would say, model that maybe can explain it a bit like easier, or make it a bit simple. And this is like a functional model. So actually there are different musical gestures because they have different functions in different musical situations. So, and then you can say, okay, when you play music, maybe you have movements that are actually have they are sound producing gestures. So they actually, you move because you want to play the instrument. So they are necessary, sound producing gestures. Then you have something like sound facilitating gestures. It's like more, it's like a supporting gesture. And maybe it's not that necessary to actually play the instrument, the movement, but it's kind of a supporting gesture or maybe an expressive gesture. So imagine you're a rock, a bass, guitar player on stage. They are not just doing movements that are really necessary to play the instrument. Yes. And then another category is maybe something like a communicative gesture, maybe like a on stage communicating gesture for the audience or something like for communicating with the audience, or maybe communicating with the other players in your group or in ensemble or orchestra or something like this. And then for sure, the fourth category, you can say you have some kind of sound accompanying gesture. And the best example for this is dance. Like, it's the kind of a gesture and movement as well, but it's actually have not the function to play music, but maybe to move to the music. Yeah, so maybe they're like, I would say it's not the only model that exists in the literature out there, but maybe this is some kind of model I used for my PhD work as well, because it's kind of clear and you can say, okay, you can divide these different categories because of the function the actual movement or the gesture have in different musical situations.
I think the first time that you mentioned musical gestures, you said that they were multimodal, if I remember that correctly. And could you maybe tell us what multimodality is and why certain musical gestures fulfill that?
Okay. I would say this multimodality is more like a thing of the perception of musical gestures or of musical movements. So for sure, like, if you're doing a musical movement, you can say it's a multimodal thing as well, because actually this is some kind of action and perception coupling. So you're always perceive and act at the same time, like the research in this regard in the last 30 years pretty much is really evident that it's not separated. But for sure, I would say the most relevant and important modalities in music performance and music perception are the auditive and the visual modality. So, this is pretty much, how do you say, clear. So everyone can imagine, okay, it's in the praxis, musical praxis, or when we recept music or listen to music in a concert or in a performance situation, always, like the most of the time, we listen and see the musicians. So this is something that, and then we come to the outcome measures as well, is very important when we try to do ratings about music performances, because then we know from different studies in this field, we know that we are doing like different judgments when we just see or just listen or doing both. So this is pretty much clear that this has an impact on it. And so during my PhD, I did like consecutive experimental studies to figure out, like, in different experimental conditions, like rating conditions, how different musical gestures was liked by the participants, or they had to judge the motion parameters, so they think maybe it's a fluent movement they have seen on the screen from a musician, and then it makes a difference if the participant just see the person without a sound or just listen to the sound and then has to judge if it's a fluent motion or not, or if the participant can see both, like a audiovisual stimuli. So this is actually really important about music perception, that it's in most of the times multimodal.
When we had, you just mentioned like the study where the participants were asked to judge if the movement was fluent. Is there a correct label so that we have like assigned that this movement is fluent and we just look if the participants recognize that, or is that something that is not compared to like an actual label, but it's like open to interpretation?
There's a difference between performance and perception, because when like what I did is like I measured different movement parameters, like I said in the beginning, like where like with the help of a motion capture system. So maybe you know this kind of images maybe from video games or producing Hollywood movies or something like this, from trailers, when you have like the suits and then you have the reflecting markers on the different joints and stuff. Yeah, I did something like this. And then you can just calculate like different motion parameters, like I said, velocity of the movement or the distance of the movement throughout the time, or then the acceleration, or one step further, you can actually calculate some kind of fluency or smoothness in the movement. And what different studies, like not during my PhD, but other studies in the field before, say like actually that people like very fluent movements. And actually when you imagine you doing something like an average movement, you tracked like 10 different movements from 10 different people, and then you're doing like calculating something like a prototypical movement. Then this is most of the time the movement the people like the most, because it's very fluent and you don't have these extreme motions. So this is not 100% in every study and so on, but this is something like a trend you can observe. So fluency, on the other hand, when you're doing like a perception experiment, is like some kind of outcome measurement that is useful to to when you want to rate musical movements as a participant. Yeah, it doesn't matter if you are an amateur or like a novice and you don't have to do anything with music at all, or you are an expert. For both like kinds of participant, it's a important movement quality, like the smoothness or the fluency, how you want to call it. Yes,
I can have a short follow-up question. Sorry, Sophie. You said that we prefer more fluent motions, and you talked about earlier when you talked about multimodality that some participants only heard the music and some participants also saw like the performance of it. Is there a trend that we recognize one as more fluent than the other, and does it maybe then indicate that it is more pleasurable, or we have more pleasure when we are observing like a certain type, so that we are only listening because then we like overestimate the fluency of the music, or is there nothing like that?
Oh, I actually don't know. I just can say it's for sure it's this perceptional process. So like these mechanisms are for sure like really high complex, and there are multiple factors that like influence actually your aesthetic rating. So it is your expertise, like, and your music preference, maybe, like, so this is a very socialized factor as well. So you have this, then you actually expertise if you're a musician for yourself or not, and then maybe there are differences in people for sure who have experiences with audiovisual music performances, so people who go out in concert regularly and going on festivals and so on, and other people, they are more like listening music without watching the musicians at home. And all these kinds of factors would actually influence your rating or your judgment. So, but if you do like an calculate, like an average, like overall, maybe I would guess that there are some, some aspects of musical performance that lots of people like more or less. So, and this is what the this prototypicality, like this average movements or the morphs, you can say, what studies with this kind of stimuli show, that actually we like this when it's very symmetric and very fluent. Yeah. So this is what I can say, but I cannot cite now like this study could prove something that you just mentioned. Yeah.
Now I'm done, Sophie. Now you can ask. Thank you.
Yeah, my question was also related to the perception. So if we have like the visual and the auditory input, so basically it was covered already.
Ah, okay.
We just talked about how pleasurable an experience might be to a listener or maybe even the performer. But what do you or what do we expect for music to affect in us? Because like when I made the introduction, I said that maybe we're in a bad mood and maybe we want to lift ourselves up and we play a certain playlist. Is that like the main effect of music, like the mood gets influenced, or is there a lot more? Is there like something else, some unexpected effect maybe? Do you have an idea about that?
Yeah, this is one of the big questions in music psychology, because I would say this idea that music does like some extra musical effects on us, this is like some kind of fascinating, and it's very old. So like this music as something that heals like kind of illnesses and all this stuff, I would say there's a huge tradition in literature back to the Greek philosophers and so on. So I would say everyone, and you can say it would be cool, right? Like if music, like it's not expensive, it's not dangerous, like all certain like aspects that maybe other kind of drugs have that affect some other things. So it would be really nice if we could say, okay, we just can use this kind of music for that, and we can use this kind of music for this, and this musical situation is good for that. But the research in the last year, I would say 20, 30 years, tried it in really like different ways and on like, how you say, different transfer effect areas, like extra musical areas. So we can, there are like some studies who can prove that maybe it's music is good for speech acquisition in the development of children. You can say And on the other hand, music have effects on emotion regulation. So as something like you said, like on something that is maybe really practical in everyday person's life. So some people are sad and then they need to listen to sad music, and some people are sad and they listen to happy music. And this is something that can be different, and it depends maybe on your personality and in your character and what you need in the certain situation. So we come back to the measurement as well. It's really hard to measure. And I would say it's like kind of a big goal to find maybe like something where you can say, okay, at the beginning of an experiment, like you have at the first measurement point, your mood is zero, and then you can measure after half an hour listening to Beethoven, your mood is one. So that would be great, but it's always not so simple as that, and because there are so many factors that influence actually your emotional reaction on music. And there are some I would say certain areas where you can say, we know that singing in a choir is good for the immune system. So this is some kind of specific area and specific types of studies. So you can say in this specific way, in this area, in this study, they show maybe it has an effect on health issues. And in another study, maybe you can say, we know that tango dancing is good for our bonding, which would have shown because of the oxytocin hormone that is rising up. So some specific things you can maybe say in certain musical areas, but I would say the most famous and mysterious effect is the Mozart effect. I don't know if you have heard of it. It's like kind of a study from the early of the 90s that was published in the Nature journal as well, where like the study have shown, okay, if you have a group of children and they listen to music and the other group just was reading, I think, and then they got a task, like a cognitive task, like a spatial cognitive task. And the group who was listening to music was like significantly higher with low effects than the other group. But actually, after this, because I would say everyone wants to have something like this, everyone reads out of this study, Mozart is so good for the development of our children and it makes us smarter. And after 30 years of research, you can say, maybe there are some kind of cognitive areas. They, in some situations, under certain conditions, you can have an effect, but it's not always, or it's not the big thing. Like it's not the, I missed the word, but maybe you know what I wanted to say. Yeah,
sometimes it's difficult to pick out what of all the things that are happening in a study is what actually plays the role. Is the choir thing like an example you just came up with, or is it something somebody found out?
No, yes, it is. There is a lot of research about it. I cited in during my master's thesis where I was looking as some kind of these quality of life, well-being and health effects of music as well. And as I said, the effects are not very strong, but there are studies who have shown that it's not just like the what you would say maybe like the secondary outcomes, so not like psychological measures or something like this, so that are even like that there are health physiological or endocrinological outcomes that that could be affected by singing in a choir.
Because with the singing in the choir and the better immune system, I'm wondering if it's just because it's a big group of people. And when you sing, you obviously produce, like, you open your mouth a lot. And as we all know with COVID, how bodily fluids and things spread, I wonder if they just have a good immune system because they're a lot around, like, a lot of people.
Yeah, there are some musical activities you can't divide in their like principal components. So you cannot sing without breathe or something like this, and the other way around. So yeah, always this kind of questions are hard to answer, but fair enough. You can say that this activity, like with all these components you just mentioned, have an effect.
And I think like the alternative, if you're not singing and you just like stand in a circle and start breathing very heavily with other random people, is like the weirder example compared to you also making music.
Yeah, maybe it's hard to get a grant for some kind of study like this or some, but it would be interesting maybe to figure it out.
I'm always very fascinated by things that are, or like have been around forever, because like we are now starting, or it feels like we are starting to study music and its effect. But if we like look back in archaeology, like we find like really, really old instruments and drums, and we know that other people have done that, or also sports probably. Like we just now start to scientifically look at these things that have been around forever and that always had like a function, because why else would you like continue to do music and pass on this gift or this ability down generations, and also like the craftsmanship of starting to make instruments. That's always like really, really fascinating to me. I don't have a concrete question, but I also just wanted to express that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Like I'm not really an expert in this music evolution field, so I don't dip so much into this, but I know some kind of theories, because the one of the big questions is like, why actually we still doing music? So is it like really important for human evolution and for humanity? And why all over the world in so much different groups with under so different circumstances, we pretty much doing everywhere something that is like music. And there are theories for sure. There are smart people who are really got into it and developed theories why it is like this. And for sure, there is one theory. It's called the musical proto-language theory, that actually our language, like our syntax and all this language skills, actually developed from just a speech that was just prosodic, so where there was no grammar and no syntax, so just different pitches in the melody of the speech. And actually then we developed some kind of other structure and grammar and syntax, but it is so human to do like give prosodic information. When I'm speaking right now, I'm doing the same. So, and this is some kind of music as well. Or lullaby songs for children is a universal musical phenomenon. Doesn't matter where the mothers and children are born and raised. So there have to be something that is some kind of important with music. Yes.
just like you mentioned, like how much it has changed, right? Because I've my first intuition, and I thought I maybe heard that somewhere that like doing music is like a social activity, and it today still is. Like there are a lot of bands and people go to concerts, but I think like with Spotify and other streaming services, it has become like very popular. You can just be alone in your room and listen to music, and like the only other person there is like the musician maybe, but it's gets rid of this social aspect of like direct interaction, but still there is a pleasurable experience. So that's but if you say like the language aspect, of course, still holds, right? If there's like an innate understanding of that musical language, then that still transfers to being alone and listening to music.
Yes. And I would say maybe like it's still a very young phenomenon, like listen to music with earphones alone in our room. But our brains are really older, right? So I don't know, 20 million of years are doing music with other people together. And now maybe 150 years of starting to get like this music reception alone. Still, we have, I would say, lots of things in our brains that are maybe linked to some social activities or and movement as well. This is a point that we do not move when we listen to music is as well a really young phenomenon of humanity. So, and still some kind of Western civilization thing. Yes.
So we've talked a lot about music and musical gestures and also perception of music. How would you say does this topic tie into cognition?
Hard question at the end. I would say like this, as I said before, like it's hard to divide action and perception actually. And I would say like you heard about this big word embodiment, but I would say that maybe this perspective on cognition has changed, like with all this, I would say, new concept of action and perception coupling, and like one big topic in music psychology research and music performance research, is this topic music embodied cognition or embodied music cognition. And so I would say there are like a lot of cognitive functions or cognitive skills that are of high importance while listening and doing and performing music. But it is always linked to our body, I would say, and some kind of action as well. So I would say I see like cognition as this word always linked to our body and movement and action, yes.
Okay. If somebody has listened to this episode and hopefully remembers all of this, but realistically, I don't think people can. What would you think are like the most important takeaway or like takeaways you would like to give people?
I would say like maybe because actually we were talking not so much about this focus of attention thing, but it's not a problem at all. More about this transfer effect of music and so on. I think this is like more fascinating for people maybe for the audience. And I would say maybe that it's not necessary to overthink like these different effects of music and think, okay, for me is music something like a tool I can use. So more accept that music is a fascinating phenomenon and do with it whatever you do, like I want to do. And I would say maybe this has the biggest effect. And it can be good for you in different musical situations, alone with headphones on the couch and at a concert as well. So maybe do not overthink like this effects. I don't know if it's a good take home message, but
I think so.
This is what comes in my mind right now.
So thank you so much for joining us today and for explaining us.
Very nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've listened to Collider Science, Conversations on Cognitive Science, hosted by Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced by Clara Kühne, Imogen Hüsing, Elisa Palmer, Leslie Volk, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced in collaboration with the Cognitive Science Student Journal. The music was produced by Jan-Lukas Schröder. The logo was designed by Annika Richter. Thank you for listening and joining us on our journey through Conversations on Cognitive Science. This podcast is not sponsored and does not give us any financial profit. If you wish to support us, the most effective way is to do so by leaving us an up to 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and following us on Instagram. You can reach out to us via mail, comment on YouTube, or message us on Instagram. We are always happy to hear your feedback. Thank you again for listening to us and for your interest in science. If you have any questions regarding this episode or any of our other episodes, feel free to reach out. You can reach out to us via Instagram by sending us a direct message at kaleidoscience_pod or write us an email at kaleidopod@us.de. You can find both links to our Instagram and also the email address in our show notes. We do read all your comments and will also reply to you as soon as we can.